Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order, 9:00 a.m. March  28th, 2019. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Machicki, Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilkowski, joined by Senate President Diesel. And we have a couple action items today. First, we're going to consider Senate Bill 54, Alaska Railroad Corporate Land Transfers. And then the second item, work item, is we're going to hear from the Department of Natural Resources about permitting, leasing, land conveyances, and the progress that they have made over the last roughly decade since there was a front-on assault on diminishing and reducing permit backlogs that started, I think, under Commissioner Sullivan, who's now Senator Sullivan. So we'll go back in time. But first up, been joined by Senator Schauer. First item, action item, is to bring back to the table Senate Bill 54, the Alaska Railroad Land Transfer. The Finance Committee heard this bill on March 20th, 2019. The bill was reviewed, and the physical note read, the physical note is zero. We've taken public testimony. There's been no amendments or concerns expressed by committee members. So I'm looking to the will of the committee. Senator Bishop, the will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move. The order of the chairs today was a little, had me out of sorts here for a second, but I guess for efficiency, you guys had a conversation. Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 54 from committee with the accompanying zero fiscal note and committee recommendations.
We have a motion on the table to move the bill from committee with the attached fiscal notes, which are zero, and individual recommendations. Do we have objection to moving the bill? Seeing none, the bill will move from committee to the next committee referral. Next item up would be DNR's presentation, the Division of Natural Resources. If the Deputy Commissioner Brent Goodrum could come forward, and he's got a presentation he's going to walk through today for us. He has a little bit of support online. If he gets stuck on a question, I told him we'd throw him a lifeline, but we're not going to throw him the lifeline right away. We're going to have him do the best he can and work through the slides. So if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then take us through your presentation, please.
Very good. Good morning, Chairman Stedman. My name is Brent Goodrum. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources, and thank you for the opportunity to be with your group this morning and talk about the permitting efforts within the Department of Natural Resources. I'm going to step through about five topics here today. We'll start with a historical backdrop to DNR's permitting efforts starting in about in the year 2011. We'll fast forward to kind of where we are today. We'll talk a little bit more about the unified permit effort that's been underway within the department for quite some time. We'll be joined by Jeff Bruno from the Office of Project Management and Permitting and talk about DNR's interagency coordination that it does, as well as coordination with federal agencies. And lastly, we'll talk a little bit about municipal entitlement land conveyances that DNR is responsible for. I'm going to first take you back in time about 8 years ago in early 2011. It's relatively easy for me to remember this point because that's the time when I first joined DNR in May of 2011. This time frame will be the initial focus of our conversation this morning. I want to first describe the importance and anatomy of what a large-scale development project within the state looks like. Most often these have either statewide or strong regional impacts with regards to infrastructure, economic growth, and opportunities for job creation. Some individuals may assume that a project only needs one permit or authorization, but in reality, large projects often require dozens of authorizations from multiple agencies in order to advance forward. Some of those types of authorizations that the Department of Natural Resources works with, a large project would need some sort of long-term lease or land position in order to develop the project. And they also would need a dedicated legal access, such as an easement, in order to lots of times acquire the funding that's necessary for their project to go forward. Another type of authorization that are shorter term are called land use permits, and those are necessary often for the construction of those large project sites. Material sales, which is essentially sand and gravel, are really important, whether it's for road access or for developing pads on the north slope or for building on the foundation of the structures. Those are critical to projects that are going forward. And lastly, water authorizations are critical not only for the development of the project, but for the long-term operation of those activities. These authorization types, leases, easements, permits, material sales, and water authorizations essentially form the major muscle movements that enable large projects to be developed and economies and jobs to be generated throughout our state. The vast majority of these authorizations that we're going to talk about today are primarily focused on general state land, is where most of my conversation will be focused on. As you all know, the state owns and manages approximately 100 million acres of uplands and about 60 million acres of tide and submerged lands. That large land base is predominantly served by the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and they've got a division of about 200 individuals or team members that are a member of that team. So in late 2010 and early 2011, following the re-election of Governor Parnell, an appointment of then Commissioner Dan Sullivan, there was perhaps this great awakening that was going on in determining that there was a bit of an issue within the DNR permitting process. The primary evidence of this was that there was this ever-growing backlog of authorizations that were acquiring before the department. The stark realization was that something significant needed to be done. And as you look at this slide, from about fiscal year 06, there were about 2,100, a little over 2,100 authorizations in backlog, ever increasing until the end of fiscal year 2011, at which 2,658 authorizations were before the Department of Natural Resources for some type of action.
Mr. Chairman.
You have a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah. Can you just define backlog? Is that just a permit, or is that a period of time that has gone on since it was applied for?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski. Backlog in this context, as it was measured at that time frame, dealt with all of the applications that were before the department with regards to those five authorization types: permits, leases, easements, material sale applications, and within water rights, you had traditional water rights and in-stream flow reservations. So we could have received an application the day before and it was counted, or it could have been there for 6 months or a year. And so at that time, with the tools that the department had, that's how it counted backlog. So it's essentially what was before the department in its work pool or inventory that needed to be addressed. So in 2011, the department was fortunate that there were some really talented and passionate professionals at DNR that were interested and willing and able to address this challenge. And so the department crafted a plan and formally submitted it to the House Finance Subcommittee in February of 2011. It stated that it's now the highest priority of the division to address this permitting backlog, and the goal was to timely process all incoming land and water use applications in order to eliminate the backlog. And on the next slide here, I'll talk about many of the components that were within that plan. Number one, the Division of Mining, Land, and Water in fiscal year 2010 had to keep about 26 positions vacant due to a lack of adequate budget or unrealizable budget that they had. And so there was a need to more fully fund positions that were within the division. The division was going to undertake a comprehensive review of all things that affected permitting. They were going to look at organizational changes. We were going to review statutes and regulations, as well as other procedures for improvements, looking at the department's appeal process and how those things interrelated, the relationship between state, federal, and local government, as well as considering what if things could be privatized. The division was going to continue to work and leverage the unified permit project that had begun somewhere about almost a decade before that, and as well as analyze, categorize, and prioritize those authorizations that were before the department, prioritizing those applications and projects that would provide the largest benefit to Alaskans. One of the authorizations or situations that really brought this to a head was that there was a large telecommunications project in the interior of Alaska that when you work in the interior of Alaska, you've got finite field seasons in which you can get things done, and so you need to mobilize people and equipment. And when you don't have the benefit of a road system, a lot of time that requires air assets. And so every day that you've got equipment and people that are idle in the field that can't move forward, it's a critical thing. And it's a very costly endeavor to anything being developed. And so this was one of the issues that really highlighted this, at least I believe, and at that point at Commissioner Sullivan's mind that really looked for him or was a catalyst for him to try and find solutions in working with the division. So the department created a statewide permitting initiative. There are about five bullets there on the right that speak to many of the tenets of that permitting initiative. Again, the objective was to process in order to advance the public interest by ensuring projects are permitted in a timely, predictable, and efficient manner while safeguarding the environment. The risk, where you have risk and uncertainty, that's lethal to investment. When projects aren't certain that they have the ability to acquire certain things, to move forward with certain things, their interest in dedicating dollars to that effort is definitely curtailed. The vast majority of these things are things that we within the Department of Natural Resources continue to look at and evaluate today. We adopted a process of continuous process improvement. We continue to evaluate how we do things and if we can do things better. We have conversations within the department on a daily basis that talks about these very issues. But DNR wasn't the only group that was working to solve this issue. The legislature played a critical role in addressing DNR's permitting challenges. The legislature took decisive action with this, primarily along three fronts. Number one was capacity. The legislature saw fit to invest more money within the Department of Natural Resources to help fill those full-time equivalent positions within the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. There were a number of legislative packages that had been considered and advanced by this body in order to help streamline the issues that were within statutes that staff members had identified that if you can improve these certain things, it would make our permitting system more efficient and effective. Additionally, the legislators supported other innovative processes that the department was looking at, both through the Unified Permit discussion that we'll have later, as well as many of the continuous process improvement efforts that were being undertaken. One of the first bills that was really critical to DMLW, the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, was House Bill 361 in 2012. There wasn't any one singular silver bullet that, you know, fixed permitting, but there were a lot of minor tweaks that were really important. One of the most important had to do with material site designations. It gave the department the ability to issue a decision one time that basically delineated where a material site was and how much material was there. Then every time there was a subsequent request for materials, material to be extracted, the decision had already been made, and so that material cell contracts could go out of that pit as long as there was still material there. And so that really streamlined that, that instead of every single time you had an application, you had to step through a tedious decision process. Additionally, there were a number of corrections that were made to leases, the opportunity to extend or to renew leases. That was a really important provision as well of some of the, one of the bills. HB 274 in 2017 was another bill that looked at some land exchange provisions that were going to be helpful, as well as two-year lease extensions was another critical important aspect of that. The other part I want to touch upon as far as people or capacity, again, the legislature did invest in the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. It more fully funded those 26 positions that were vacant within the division. In addition, in fiscal year 12, it added six positions that were one-time increments. In fiscal year 13, the legislature saw fit to incorporate those within the base of the division, as well as it added a another monetary value, just sort of $1 million, to help reduce the vacancy rate within the department. And so the legislature did take many affirmative actions to help DNR begin to address this issue.
And before you go to the next slide, Mr. Goodrum, I think you had a deja vu moment here at the beginning of the meeting. You want to mention that possibly? Or you want me to help you with that?
You might have to help me, Mr. Chair.
Several years ago, 2011, I think Senator Geisel was in the Senate then, in 11. Senator Olson was at this table, Senator Bethel, and the Senator from the Southeast Islands. We're all sitting at this table with DNR working on this subject. So this is kind of a review or an update for us, because it was alarming when it became apparent to the legislature that we had that significant backlog. And it was slowing down our development in our oil basin and other issues that DNR was dealing with. And we, as Mr. Goodrum had mentioned, and I think he was a fairly new hire at DNR at the time. So this was one of his first experiences at the table dealing with this. And it's almost a decade later, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So now he's in the hot seat explaining all the good things that the department has done to fix that issue. So I just thought I was just thinking about that during the meeting. I thought I'd mention that because it's been an ongoing issue, and I think he's going to go into some successes of it.
Yes, sir. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the leases that was not captured in previous legislation for the ability to either renew or extend was aquatic farm leases. At that time, it wasn't really considered. We didn't get many applications on an annual basis, and so I've got a couple slides later dedicated to some of that topic coming up, but I just wanted to highlight it at this point. So now I'm going to talk about kind of where we are today. I'm going to fast forward, you know, about 8 years and talk about some of the numbers and where things sit. Now, I'm going to apologize right off the front. I printed this out even by an 11 by 17, and it was incredibly difficult to read, but I took some little notes here, and I'll explain what some of this is. This is what the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, their active case file load is. There's about 77,500 authorizations that are active that the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, 200 personnel, manage and oversee. That's about 400 case files per individual for a full-time employee, if you exclude the just scant number of administrative folks that are within the division to support its functions. And so there's an extremely voluminous amount of files and case files that the division is responsible for. There are about 36,800 mining claims. That's the largest portion of that 47.5 you see on the right side of that donut there. As you work clockwise, if you go to the bottom, There's about 11% of it's in land sale type authorizations, and those are about 8,600 authorizations. Water rights, as you continue to the left there, there's about 18,500 case files that the division actively manages and does so with about a dozen people that work water rights. There's an other category that's got about 10,000 authorizations, and at the very top in that small sliver, easements comprise about 3,400 of the authorizations. This is just that same information portrayed in another way with incredibly small font, and I really apologize. Just another way of depicting it at the bottom is the mining claims. You can see that bar that extends out. Then it's followed just above it by water rights, land sales, easements, permits, other leases, and as you work your way up. So just another way to display that same information. The backlog, if we look at it, how it was calculated, that its high point was there in fiscal year 2011, 2,658 authorizations in backlog. We saw a very precipitous drop once we began that effort, a number of low-hanging fruit that we were able to find and address quickly. As you continue to winnow that low-hanging fruit, you get into more complex issues that have been around for a while. But by fiscal year 16, we had driven the backlog down to 938. And to Senator Wilikowski's question earlier, although it's called backlog, those numbers at the time when it was taken, if you had received an application just a day before or a week before, it's captured within that number. And so there are authorizations that we know anticipated timeframes and on how long we think those authorizations should take. That backlog number doesn't account for it being in that normal process in which we would anticipate an authorization to go. So we have some work to do to better refine and really capture this, but if you consider this, really this is what the workload is that's before the Division of Mining, Land, and Water within the Department of Natural Resources. That's important to note. And I will say, just as a generalization, it's probably close to about 50% of that number that you see for each of those years is probably within its normal operating time frame that you would anticipate it, at least as I'm looking at calendar year 18. So about 500 of that number is. The other 500 is probably languished a bit longer than what we think. One other thing that I'll talk to just a little bit, part of the backlog calculation had to do with water rights, and I just want to make a comment about water rights that were captured within this. One of them is traditional water rights were a first-in-time, first-in-right appropriation state. So when you have a substantially complete application that comes in, that application is date-stamped. That puts you in line as far as water priority. And so there isn't anyone that would come after you that could bump you out in a water priority situation. And so traditional water rights from the perspective of the ability to delay or prohibit projects from going forward is really a misnomer. The most important thing that isn't captured within backlog is temporary water use authorizations. That's where you have projects that are either building out roads or necessary for foundations or building ice roads on the North Slope, where you've got a temporary authorization that never matures into a water right, but it allows water to be used to a beneficial use to allow projects to go forward. That has never been captured as part of the backlog, and for the most part, definitely on the North Slope, temporary water use authorizations. The division works very hard to ensure that those are timely issued so that activities, when you have finite seasons, can take place during those important windows.
So, Senator Wilikowski.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious what the time is, how long it takes to process, because that seems to be a more accurate indication of how how you're processing this. Do you have any data on that from FY11 to the present, how long it takes to process an application?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we have general timelines, permits and material sales generally within 90 days, leases and easements traditionally closer to 18 months, and that has to do to survey requirements, appraisal requirements, generally a two-step decision, a preliminary decision with public comment opportunity, and a final decision, and then you've got appeal windows and things like that. The department can continue to work to try and get you some more numbers as far as actual timelines that it takes, but it's something that we're conscious of and we continue to work. One of the other things that we haven't had good tools to help capture is many times if the department is working an application, sometimes there's an iterative back and forth between needing additional information from an applicant, and sometimes, you know, we reach out to an applicant and sometimes communication doesn't work as well as it should. And so say we go out and request additional information, we don't have enough staff to, on a daily basis, go back and remind people, or on a weekly basis and say, hey, by the way, we asked for this information, you know, we provide it. Sometimes when we ask for information, we don't ever get any information back. But that's a great question, Senator, and I can work with staff to try and get you some average times of some of these current authorizations that the department is issuing.
If you can bring that back to the committee, and we'll just dispense it amongst committee members. And then you were talking about, Mr. Goodrum, you were talking about the water rights and some of the impacts of the bigger projects, but the mom and pop that have remote cabins and remote parcels around the state, a lot of which, you know, is the old DNR land that you've been selling and other properties. Could you give us a little synopsis of when somebody should file for water rights and when they shouldn't get too concerned about that for the all these remote parcels?
Mr. Chair, I would encourage anyone at their earliest opportunity to come in and apply. As I mentioned earlier, once you have a substantially complete application, the applicant gets a date stamp that gives them a priority date that would be ahead of anyone that comes afterwards. Unfortunately, when you have a limited amount of capacity and you have to evaluate which projects you're able to pick up and work on, when you have large projects that are of significant economic potential to the state, some of those projects obviously, perhaps rightfully, move to the front of the queue. And unfortunately, it's some of the smaller mom and pops, unfortunately, that probably slide back a little bit in the queue. And unfortunately, their authorizations take a little bit longer because of this effort.
The question wasn't geared to the timing. I think most people recognize that if you have a remote cabin somewhere and you're going to want a water supply to your cabin, is not quite the significance of expanding in our oil basin or opening up a mine or dealing with some of the bigger statewide vital interests. It was more along the lines of if you have a remote cabin homestead, at what size water requirement that you, or water needs do you have, should you look as a threshold to go ahead and apply so you can get date stamped?
Very good. Thank you for the clarification, Mr. Chair. I believe the threshold is 500 gallons per day. Senator Bishop is
5,000.
5,000. Number one, I would recommend they contact the water section and kind of have a quick conversation with them and talk about what their water needs, and then the water section can best advise them. If they're below that threshold, then a authorization or a certificate is not required. Although if they wanted to apply, to ensure that their water right is protected over the long haul, I would just encourage them to reach out to the water section, who can be reached. We've got water folks here in Juneau, in Fairbanks, and in Anchorage, and can best talk to each of them about their unique circumstance. But there is a threshold amount of water that, if you use on a daily basis, doesn't require an authorization.
So if I'm interpreting that correctly, if you have a family of seven kids or no kids, you're most likely not going to use 5,000 gallons a day to run your cabin or your home. So it's not of a real pertinent issue to go ahead and file for that permit, or should you just help me with a more, I guess, granular answer to the question, if you could?
Through the chair, if you're below that threshold, a water certificate is not required because you have the ability to use up unto that on a daily basis. And so they would be fine. I would still just encourage them to reach out and chat with someone within one of the water sections, three locations.
Fair enough. Senator?
Clarification. On the water rights permit, 5,000 gallons and above goes out for a comment period. So I'm partially wrong and partially right. So over 5,000 gallons a day goes to a further public comment period for a water right.
That's fine. We'll go ahead and continue. I just wanted to clarify that for those listening around the state that have bought remote property and are taking some water out of a creek for their cabin or packing it in 5-gallon buckets like we did when I was a kid, that they don't have to worry about the state coming after them and taking away their water rights or somebody filing over them.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on that point, but you're right, though. I mean, you never know when somebody might go upstream of you, so you want to have your water right application on your cabin. Who knows that somebody might go upstream and try to make a bigger water right or try to apply for a reservation. So,
okay, we'll go ahead and we'll get back on track here. Go ahead and do your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So from the high of 2,658 authorizations in 2011, where we sit today in 2018, at the end of calendar year 2018, it was a 61.8% reduction in that number. During that time, you can see over the last few years that that number's creeped up a little bit. Since fiscal year 15, Division of Mining, Land and Waters lost about 13 permanent full-time positions. The department as a whole, continues to face challenges like many other departments within the state, in its ability to recruit, train, and retain highly skilled professionals dedicated to doing this work. One of the things that the legislature can most help with is a good, stable fiscal plan that allows predictability. And again, when we talked about uncertainty and risk, to the degree that the state is able to have a sound budget that's predictable, that helps on hiring and retention of folks. So the other part that we know within the department we have to do is we have to do some educational outreach as far as communicating with our applicants, ensuring that they know that we don't have staff, that we're able to repeatedly go back and remind folks when we're trying to gain additional information to help advance authorizations. But we've got a lot of work to do. We've done some good work, and we're going to keep working at it. Again, apologize some of the small font. I can highlight some of the most important things. If you work at the top left, those have to do, there's talking about permits, both applications and issued. And so from 2011 through 2013, the average number of permit applications that the division got was 421. That number increased 12% from when you look at years 2015 through 2018, up to 471 permits that we got. The number of issued authorizations as far as permits, we went down slightly. In 2018, our average was about 445 permit applications went out. In the bottom left, we're looking at easements. Between 2011 and 2013, we had an average of about 68 easements that came in. From 2015 through 2018, that number increased 37% to about 93 easements that come in the door on an annual basis. We are increasing the number of easements annually that go up, that go out. We're about at 107 easements, which is an increase of about 8% of what we did in the 2011 to 2013 timeframe. With regards to leases, this is the area where we've seen the greatest growth within the state. In 2011 through 2013, we had about 85 applications that came in the door. That number increased significantly to 224. Some of that may be how some of these applications are later characterized, but that's a 162% increase in the number of leases that come in. We are issuing more leases on an annual basis now. We're up to about 193 that go out the door, which is a 79% increase over what we did in the 2011 through 2013 timeframe.
Go ahead and finish your slide, and then we'll come to the questions.
Lastly, on material sales, applications are down from about 66 in 21 through 2013 to about 60, which is about a 10% decrease. We're issuing just on average about one more material sale contract, which is about a 2% increase in what we're doing. What I will say is people may look and say, why your applications and issue don't always add up. Some of it has to do with some applications never go all the way to an issued status. Sometimes an applicant will have a certain window or a certain project that they're hoping to happen, and they apply for an application, but certain things fall through, or they decide they're going to do something else. And so many times applications are closed out before they're finally seen all the way through. Maybe I'll see if I can take the senator's
right question. If you're done with the slides, we'll go to the questions, and we'll start with Senator Bishop.
On the increase in leases, do you have that broken out by lease? Meaning, where I'm going with this is this a significant number of the mining community converting from their annual claim payments and going to a lease option, as an example?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I don't have that information broken out here in front of me. What I can do is provide back to the committee what that lease breakout is. Some of it has to do with aquatic leases that we've seen in 2017 and 2018. I would imagine, as you're suggesting, that there are some mining leases, conversions from claims to leases, that may also be captured in that as well.
And then maybe when you come back to the committee with that carve out as an item, if there's any significance to structures across easements, structures across a property line, older structures. I know around the state sometimes when people go to sell a home, they find out that they're crowded the waterfront a little too tight, and they're actually, or their fill is sitting on DNR land, and rather than have them remove their structure, tear down their house, the DNR then allows them to lease the land so they could have a clean title report to move their sale forward. And I know that's been happening several times in the island region, and that might be a subcomponent of these lease increases, but I'd like to find out if that's in fact true. And then if there's any other, Senator Bishop carved out the mining, you might as well try to categorize it to oil and gas leases issues, if there's any of that. And so we can kind of get the idea of, or the feel for commercial lease structures versus leases that we're dealing with that are more along the lines of the residential or the non-economic driving sector of the state. And we'll go to Senator Showern and back to Bishop.
Thank you, excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. For the miners, as you're looking at the workload overall, are they still required to file paper? I know there was the question that had come up before about digital versus paper. Not every sourdough has access and out in the bush. But if they're required to file yearly paperwork, how much of that results in any enforcement action? And kind of as I ask that question is, If it doesn't, or there's very little, have you looked at the option of maybe going to like a two-year reporting or something different to kind of back off on the workload required based on what you're actually seeing in the field?
Through the chair, Representative or Senator Schauer, or me, your first question had to do with paper or electronic. We continue to try and find ways that make it easier for minors to apply and submit paperwork that's required. They currently do have requirements for annual affidavits of labor, which as part of having a mining right, you're required to do labor on that, and you either do that labor or you pay an in-lieu fee. And so there are certain filing requirements that are required. The second part of your question gets into, you know, are you able to extend that time period in which you do those requirements, maybe make them every other year as opposed to annually? That is not something yet that we have spent a lot of time on. We do issue authorizations, permits, miscellaneous land use permits that are multi-year permits up to 5 years. So from a permitting perspective, you know, we look at that. Same thing with leases, whether you're a 10-year or 25-year lease. Those authorizations that allow for a longer time frame are helpful because you're not churning through that on an annual basis. But we haven't yet looked at some of those mining requirements on a slightly extended time frame. You had one other question, I believe, through the chair that dealt with follow-up enforcement. Most of DNR's regulatory enforcement would have to do with reclamation activities, less so paperwork. There's provisions in statute and regulation that if there's errors, it doesn't so much cause an enforcement action. Sometimes it's an operation of law that certain activities will take place, like potentially losing a claim. Administratively, there's also potential for cure to fix that situation. But as far as enforcement, most of DNR's enforcement activities would be based upon activities that we observe on the ground, whether it's some sort of issue with reclamation not being done correctly, or some sort of diversion of water that wasn't applied for or done in an appropriate way. So that is where the majority of DNR's enforcement and education process and working with the mining community about how we do things correctly within the state of Alaska.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Just if you took a look at that and decided that you were going to extend that, maybe go to 2-year reporting instead of one for workload requirements on both the state and the miners, et cetera, is that something you can do yourself, or would that require legislative action?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, that type of change, because some of the requirements are captured in statute about annual requirements, that would require a legislative action.
Okay, go ahead and continue. Oh, excuse me, wait, we got Senator Bishop. I almost forgot there was a question backed up on that one.
Just curious on the 10% reduction in material sales, that's money into the state treasury, and I'd just be curious to where those 10% reduction was, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, my hypothesis in looking at that, obviously the last 4 years or so, there's been more constrained budget. There's been a smaller capital budget. There's been restrained activity, perhaps, in the amount of projects that DOT is able to do. DOT is one of the primary or major purchases of material. It isn't that they're perhaps buying it elsewhere. I think there's probably just less activity, and I think that coincides with what we're generally observing within road projects and things like that throughout the state. So that would be my guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And then if I could just add to that, I think there was a change several years ago where we dropped the requirement for smaller rock pits to have permits and pay royalties to the state. Some of those contractors, I think, for decades had not paid, and we cleaned that up. Can you help me with that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, I will have to get you back some more information on that.
That's fine.
Just that subject eludes me at this moment.
Right, but as I recall, we cleaned that up around the state, as the state is the owner of the subsurface. So we have further questions on the slide before we go to the next one? Okay, go ahead and continue.
This is just a snapshot of current land use applications that are before. This would include both applications received and applications complete. If you work on the right side of the pie chart there, that 41% represents about just over 250 easements. That is with the Division of Mining, Land and Water. There's about 114 land leases that are being worked by the division. As you continue to around the clock, material sales, there's about 38 applications that are within the division. There's about 87 other leases that are being worked, and there are about 131 permits, which is that orange slice of the pie there. That represents that 632 that are currently being worked by the division.
Okay, I've got a Senator Wilson. You have a question? Okay, I've got a question and a concern. DNR has some land sales around the state, and this deals with setbacks from waterfront. And as your waterfront property is very valuable, and as you increase the setback from the front, obviously at some point you diminish the waterfront value and attractiveness. I see in that it's not uniform around the state. I think through some planning practice that went through several governors ago, I think it was under Knowles, Southern Southeast has a 100-foot setback on the waterfront. Nacogdoches subdivision outside of Sitka is a prime example to actually look at one that has a 100-foot setback. And the concern is a diminishment of waterfront value, which would then diminish the coffers of the Treasury when we sell land. And I recognize that there's access requirements for the public along the waterfront. And normally the setback is 50 feet or less. The university, I've seen, uses 25 sometimes. Some of the municipalities, frankly, use a zero setback on the waterfront. So I guess the concern and the question is, why do we have differential setbacks, and why would we have setbacks at such a magnitude of 100 feet to diminish our land value? And then when we try to sell it, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. So if you can help me with that a little bit and then get back to the committee on that whole easement issue, setbacks, there's easements and setbacks. Sometimes the easements are also not defined. In other words, it's not defined as a pedestrian access easement. It's just an easement, so it could be a bulldozer come rolling through, or a four-wheeler at 4 in the morning, or what have you. So I think there's some issues with how we, or the lack of definitions on those that I think at some point we need to try to clean up.
Thank you for the chair, or for the question, Mr. Chair. You're right. I believe it's Alaska Statute 3805-127 is the statute with regards to tune-along easements. There are occasions when the local platting authority may have additional requirements or desires for setbacks. The Department of Natural Resources also works in close coordination with Alaska Department of Fish and Game with regards to what some of these might be. I've rapidly run out of my expertise on this issue. I know you've got some questions you'd like us to come back with you on, and so I'd like to be able to do that and get you some more information.
Okay, and thank you for parsing the question also, because there is a difference between unorganized areas and organized that have platting authority. And clearly when you have platting authority, you've got a planning commission and a public process to deal with easements. But these requirements from DNR far exceed at least the local platting requirements that I'm aware of in
any of the communities I represent, multiple fold. So I think what my concern is we're hurting the value of our waterfront property.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and we'll look to get you an answer back.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Thank you. Aquatic farm leasing. This is kind of an exciting and expanding industry here within the state. In February of 2016, the previous administration stood up an Alaska Mariculture Task Force. Part of the fruits of that were an explosion of applications and interest in this industry that's continuing to grow and emerge. You can see that for a number of years, from 2012 through 2016, we either had two or one applications on an annual basis. In 2017, we had a total of, 17 applications came in 2017, and we had 16 applications the following year. It's something that the division is working to catch up with, and I'll talk in the next couple slides what the division's doing to try and keep up with this emerging industry.
Senator Wilson.
Can you give me a brief overview of the industry?
I'm sorry?
Can you give me a brief overview of that industry? What does that entail?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the Mariculture Task Force was a group that was stood up in 2016. Basically, you're looking at your tide and submerged lands, and you're looking at everything from oysters to shellfish to sea cucumbers, kelp, gooey ducks, all sorts of different things that can be grown in the tidelands and beyond. You know, essentially our blue water industry, I believe, is another term that they use for it. So the desire or goal was by 2040 to create an industry that generates a revenue or has a product value of about $100 million. I think that's currently close to on par with what our timber industry is nowadays currently. And so a pretty ambitious goal. I believe just last year there was another bill that was signed that has to do with Mariculture Revolving Loan Fund, which helps provide probably moderate interest loans to people looking to get into this industry. There are activities in some of these applications everywhere from Ketchikan, Craig, Sitka, Hoonah, Juneau, Cordova, Seward, Homer, Kodiak, the Aleutians, and probably beyond. And so, as you know, the state of Alaska has got about, I believe it's 30,000 miles of coastline. So we have a wide frontage area of being able to develop this industry here. So it's in the early stages, but it's one that's having increased growth and increased interest.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be really quick on this slide. Current adjudication process, I will say, is probably too long, anywhere from 12 to 24 months. There are a number of requirements, public notice processes, various other things in there. The bottom bullet says the division is currently working on streamlining this process, figuring out where we can compress things in order to get good, responsible decisions out the door, looking to get it down closer to 9 to 12 months in that process. What I'll talk about on the next slide is in the last just over 2 years, we've had 36 new applications. As I mentioned, 17 were in 2017, 16 in 2018. We have three already received this year. The window for applications for them to come in is will close on April 30th, so we're still open for more applications. We do this in conjunction, we the department do this in conjunction with the Department of Fish and Game, and so we've already had an agency review of the different projects that are before both agencies, and so we've looked at all of the 2018 applications. With regards to the 2017 one, we've got 18 that have already been, decisions have already been, made, and they're either issued or have been sent out to the lessee for action. Six files are still being adjudicated. Three of those 2017 files were closed. We realized that we were probably a little bit flat-footed on this, and we're working to catch up. And so we know we've got work to do, but we're trying to catch up with this emerging industry.
Right, and I think my understanding is the scale of what the permittees are applying for is substantially increasing, probably more than tenfold. It's a huge difference, and that there's a lot of private capital, or at least some private capital, sitting on the sidelines waiting for the permitting process. So this is a up-and-coming industry. So could you, if you happen to know this, the scale differences, could you give the committee a feel for that? Or, and if you don't, you can, you know, get back to us so we can get a feel for it. And then after that answer, we'll have a question from Senator Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I believe some of the scale had to do with previous historic applications that we get would be on small number of singular number of acreages that were being requested, primarily whether it was for oysters or shellfish or gooey ducks. Now when we're looking at things such as kelp and other things, we're getting applications for lease sizes, you know, into the hundreds of acres. So it's a significant increase in the amount of footage that's being requested. And so that's kind of just a rough magnitude, but we can provide information back that shares some more of those acreage sizes that, you know, were more traditional and what we're seeing now after this initiative or task force has been generated.
Okay, and then kind of the time frame on those permits and status, because they are significant. And after Senator Wilson's question, Senator Machicki has one.
Very good.
And then Senator Von Imhoff.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two quick questions. One, who handles the adjudication process, and what are the average costs of a lease of those sizes?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, the first question is who adjudicates it, or?
Yes, the adjudication, yes.
Right, so we have one singular manager for the mariculture industry in all of Alaska, and it's located in Anchorage, so one individual. We have worked to provide additional capacity to help accelerate some of these other applications that are there. As far as the revenue piece, I have Chris Hess on the line, who's the deputy director for the Division of Mining, Land and Water, and I believe she has some numbers in front of you that can give you an idea of what some of the economic return or what some of those costs are associated with the leases, if that would be helpful.
Okay, we'll bring in Ms. Hess. If she could come online, please identify herself for the record.
This is Chris Hess. I'm the deputy director with the Division of Mining, Land and Water, Alaska Department of Natural Resources. I believe it was Senator Schauer through the chair.
Senator Wilson.
In terms of...
Senator Wilson.
We're off on the mat.
Oh, sorry about that. Senator Wilson, through the chair. With regard to the fees, the application fees for aquatic farm leases, it depends on the acreage. So an application for a site that is 1 acre or less is a fee of $600. If it's greater than 1 acre to no more than 3 acres, the application fee is $1,200, and if the application for an aquatic farm, the site is going to be greater than 3 acres, the application fee is $2,000. In terms of the annual fees that are charged, we have a fee schedule on Mining, Land and Water's website that discusses the fees for the annual lease. So if it's a lease site that's up to 30 acres in size, the annual rental fee is $450 for the first acre or a portion thereof, and then $125 for each additional acre. So for example, if you had a 2-acre site, aquatic farm site, the annual lease fee would be $575. It, if you're more than 30 acres, if you're applying for a site that's greater than 30 acres, again, you'd have that a base fee, and it's the fees are actually reduced if the size is greater than 30 acres, and it's $125 for each additional acre other than beyond that first acre. So, for example, if you had a 30-acre aquatic farm site, the annual lease fee would be $4,075, which is the $450 plus the fees on there, which would get you to the $4,075. And we can provide this in writing because I know I'm throwing a lot of numbers out there and a lot of facts. So as part of the follow-up, we'd be more than happy to give that information in addition to the lease sites.
That's fine. That's fine.
This year, actually, this month in March of 2019 was the first lease.
We want to move on. So we have the next question, Senator Machicki.
I guess I was just wondering if you're working in partnership with Commerce or anyone like that to help. Every time an aquaculture issue comes up, I just recognize that the kind of non-coastal legislators don't have a lot of exposure to its potential. And being that this is finance, I always say that we have a tendency to look at general funds that are going out, but we don't look at general funds that aren't going out. I mean, there are a lot of Alaskans making their own way in these industries, and there's an enormous amount of future potential in aquatic farming in coastal Alaska. So just wondering if there's any potential for you to gather up. I mean, you're talking about sort of how the permitting works, and that's your focus, but it'd be nice if something more informative could be sort of released for legislators and the public to understand how it works, what's happening, and the potential for the future, because it's enormous.
We could have the deputy come back with what data they have, but we also have representations from the industry around the building, and we can have that delivered, get that data gathered up and back to the committee so they can see the scale. I think we have, who was next, Senator Wilson, were you next? Von Imhoff, then Wilson, then Wilikowski.
Thank you. This question, Chair Stedman, dovetails with Senator Machicki's. The other factor in these aquatic farm lease applications are the loans to this industry via the Department of Commerce. I think we had a presentation last year. So I hope that your department is also working in conjunction with the Department of Commerce specifically to ask who's applying for those loans. How are those applications doing? How far down the line are there? Is there a backlog of applications? Because I think by giving permits, we want to make sure that these people who are applying are successful. And, of course, they need a lot of them need the loans, which we saw last year at this committee. So to what degree are you working with the Department of Commerce, similar to what Machicki asked, in particular with the loans for this industry?
Through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I will ensure going forward that we make prompt contact with them specifically with regards to loan applications and have a conversation. I know we had staff just the other day participate. I believe it was in another mariculture task force, you know, conversation that we had people participate. But to my knowledge, I'm not certain that we have made that important connection with Commerce to date, but we will do so.
Senator Wilson.
Yeah. Can the Office of Administration, can the Office of Admin hear and assist with the sort of the backlog or with this process at all?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, the question was could another agency help with some of the backlog with regards to applications?
Application adjudication process, just, yeah.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilson, it's, they wouldn't have authority to necessarily issue those authorizations. Those, that authority resides within Department of Natural Resources. And so we will continue to find ways to increase our capacity internally to meet those requirements. But I'm confident that the department can handle it.
Senator Wilson or Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a request, and it's not even for you, but it's if we're getting more information on this, I know Fish and Game had for years expressed concerns and even opposition over the expansion of these aquatic farms. And I'd be interested in hearing from them on if those concerns are still in existence or impacts on native stock, for example. So that'd be my request, Mr. Chairman, from Fish and Game.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a resource committee question and not so much the budget committee. So I'll get with you, Senator Wilkowski, on how to get that information you requested at the appropriate location in the legislature. Other questions on this slide? Okay, go ahead and continue.
Thank you. I'll quickly touch upon unified permit effort and where that's been. That effort first started back as early as fiscal year 2002, and that would have been within the Department of Natural Resources looking to refine what sort of requirements the department needed for its duties and tasks. And so that took a number of years to kind of evolve. In fiscal year 2006 through 2009, the department started working on data entry capabilities, content management system, and scanning of legacy files, moving more towards an electronic system. As you advance to 2010, that's when DNR kind of had that aha moment or that great awakening about the number of authorizations that were truly in front of it. And so in 2010, it rolled out the DNR's Business Reporting System, or DBRS, and that's probably when they first started hooking everything up and saying, how many things do we have here? And that number looked quite large and probably shocking. And so that was the impetus for follow-on action that we saw from fiscal year 11 to current date. We continue to develop processes and systems using a number of different tools, both for our adjudicators and hopefully for the public as well, to help make that process more effective and more efficient. In stepping through this with Unified Permit, it has allowed the department to go to an electronic case file, so it just wasn't the hard copy that someone had on their desk somewhere or somewhere in a drawer or a file cabinet. You actually had things that multiple people could see and look at and work and adjust in advance. And so moving to an electronic case file was really important. The electronic scanning of a lot of our historical documents is really important for us to understand what authorizations were issued before, what the stipulations were, how to work with those going forward. It also helped create greater consistency between our different regions, primarily our northern region in Fairbanks, our south central in Anchorage, and our southeast here in Juneau. Different offices were sometimes issuing decisions slightly differently, which introduces some legal risk. And so where we've helped add greater consistency, we've added to the defensibility of the department's decisions. And so there's been a maturation of that as we've advanced through this process. We still have work to do as we go forward. The project continues to take us through potentially fiscal year 21. But the tools that are provided are very helpful to our adjudicators and to our staff.
Okay, before we go to that slide, just the verb you used, shocking, I think it was accurate. As I recall, the committee was surprised and frankly kind of shocked at the backlog at DNR, and thankful that DNR brought it forward under then Commissioner Sullivan, so collaboratively we could work together to resolve it, which we took it on head on because it appeared that if we didn't deal with it, it was just going to get worse. And we were worried about impacts on our ability to extract resources and run a resource state. So I think you chose your words correctly. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that's one of the bigger problems has been the differences between the regions. You just mentioned that. If you were to put that on a scale of 1 to 100 percentage-wise, how much progress have you made? You're 50% of the way, 70% of the way, how much is left? And then a secondary question is, you had mentioned it before, so I'm going back just a little bit, but how much coordination – would you say takes place between Fish and Game and DNR, when, as opposed to like a unilateral decision? But do you reach out to them? Do you ask for that kind of input and that collaboration between them before DNR just makes a decision on whether you're going to approve something or not?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, I just want to make sure I understood your first question correctly. The question was, how much is left with regards to
smoothing out between the three regions, knowing that that was a big part of the problem? So if you were just to throw out a number and say, we're halfway there, we're three quarters of it, where do you sit in trying to resolve that, what's a pretty major problem that you've had in the past?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, I view it as an opportunity, and if a 1 to 100, or a 0 to 100 scale, I would say that we're probably about 78.5. I mean, we're moving in the right direction. There's always work to be done, but I think we've made good progress. There's great communication between our regional offices within the division, so I think that that is on a really good track, and I feel very comfortable about where the department and the division is going with regards to that. You kind of teased out a couple slides ahead. We're going to talk with the Office of Project Management and Permitting that does that coordination, and I'll let Jeff Bruno, when we get to that slide, speak to that, if that's okay.
Go ahead and continue.
Just so you have some knowledge of how the unified permit system needs to work, it needs to have a reporting component. It needs to have some sort of business process management engine. Currently, we use something that's called .NET. It's a Microsoft Office product that allows people to coordinate it. We also have another tool called AgilePoint, which has some low-code capability, which means that you can have terms called citizen developers, which essentially are smart adjudicators who are able to create things pretty quickly in that, and they provide great tools for us. Additionally, you need to have a content management system. That's essentially where all your data resides. And so those three components all work together and help provide tools so that the department is able to make better sense of our data, where things are at, make better decisions going forward. And so those are the critical components that we have. In addition to that, you have things like GIS capabilities that we seek to leverage and utilize. There's lots of different tools that are important. It's kind of a suite of different capabilities available to our adjudicators and managers to manage their workload, to see data, to make good decisions based upon what's there. And so that essentially is what the Unified Permit Project has been and continues to be as we move forward. The end product of using something like this, on the right side you see we're introducing less free work. You've got less variability or variation. Improves visibility where things are. You're not just looking for hard files in someone's desk or cabinet or things that probably happened for a number of years. You reduce errors, and you have smoother handoffs between adjudicators, managers, applicants, and things like that. So those are all some of the reasons why it's important to be able to use some of those more modern capabilities to help our permitting system be more efficient and more effective.
Okay, go ahead.
At this time, back to Senator Schauer's question about coordination with other agencies. I've got Jeff Bruno, I believe, perhaps on the line. Jeff is with the Office of Project Management and Permitting. They provide that function within DNR in the state to help coordinate activities. And before I steal too much of his line, I'd like to give him an opportunity to speak to it if we could.
So is there a plan to have him speak to these next two slides?
If I could, sir.
Okay, so we're on slide 24. Mr. Bruno, go ahead and speak to slide 24. When you're done, just stop for a minute in case there's questions. I'll cue you up then. And if there's no questions, I'll cue you up to move on to slide 25, and you can go through slide 25 in the same process. When you're done, just stop, and I'll look for questions. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and take us through slide 24, please.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jeff Bruno with DNR, Office of Project Management and Permitting. I'm here today to talk a little bit about the OPUMP model and how our office coordinates a variety of projects that require multiple state, federal, and local permits, and the benefits this model can offer to state agencies, project proponents and applicants, and other stakeholders along the way. First, it's important to understand that OPMP, Office of Project Management and Permitting, is a voluntary program where project proponents sign into this model and they agree to reimburse state agencies for all services rendered on their project. This doesn't just include OPMP's time and services rendered on the project, it also includes Fish and Game's time on the project, DEC, and any other agency that's involved with it. In exchange for that, the project proponent receives a more transparent, robust, and heavily coordinated project and process. And additionally, as far as we know, this is the only model, this model is unique to the state of Alaska and has not been produced in other states. So how that process works. OPMP is really set up to just be a one-stop shop for applicants, regulators, and the general public. In general, that means we either have the answers to the questions that people have, or we know where to get them, or set up the right meetings to find out answers to those questions. OPMP really efficiently coordinates projects by using established relationships, communication protocols, procedural protocols with state agencies, Fish and Game, DEC, but also we have those procedures when dealing with federal and local authorities throughout their processes. Ideally, there's a lot of federal coordination that goes on early on in the process with environmental impact statements, and OPMP also works heavily in that arena. Each project is assigned a project coordinator who is responsible for doing a variety of different things, but ultimately managing the project as a whole. Those coordinators are responsible for setting up timelines and permitting schedules, coordinating the state's involvement on federal reviews and authorizations, identifying which data gaps have the longest lead time so we're not waiting on those at the end of the process, and establishing regularly scheduled meetings for project overviews, but also project-specific or permit-specific meetings when appropriate. Ultimately, we're trying to assure that each agency has the information they need to make a timely and defensible decision. It's important that the project coordinator tracks the flow of that information between the applicant and the agencies to make sure it's going to consistently meet the project timelines and schedules. Let's stop there for the first slide.
Okay, do we have any questions on slide 24? Seeing none, go ahead and continue on to slide 25, please.
Yep. So ultimately, while each project is very unique, this coordinated model that OPMP uses has been proven across multiple industries and project types. OPMP manages a variety of projects, including oil and gas projects, and mining is kind of the foundation of our project portfolio, but we also manage a lot of transportation and renewable energy projects also. And again, this model has been proven effective regardless really of project type or project size. The benefits we see from this model is a more efficient process. Ideally, the coordinated effort frees up adjudicators and permitters to spend more time writing permits, not just for this project, but for any additional permits they have in their queue. More consistent communication, not just between the applicant and the regulators, but also between state, federal, and local agencies. A reduction in duplicated efforts by somebody constantly managing the project. Better information sharing between agencies, making sure that we're sharing consistent information, the most up-to-date information, and ultimately a more transparent process by how the coordinators and how the model sets up permitting schedules and timelines and really sets clear expectations early on in the process. Ultimately, all this allows permits and authorizations decisions to be made in a more timely, efficient, and coordinated manner, and ideally helps all stakeholders along the way on how that works. I think that's probably the end of that slide also.
Hey, Senator Wilson, you have a question on slide 25.
Yeah, what's the average timeline for some of these large oil and gas projects and mining projects?
Could you help us,
just very basic,
Mr. Bruno, on the current timeline for the oil and gas project, particularly oil, and then kind of what you recall historically was a timeline?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, you know, that is a tough question, but I would say, you know, just to take a rough stab at it and give you an idea, you know, the Nanushuk project that we're working on is shooting for about, you know, from the beginning of the permitting process, which is kind of a relative term, but let's just say it started recently, to when they're going to hope to flow first oil. That project is going to be about 5 or 6 years throughout the entire process. That's a rough stab at the timeline. Mining projects have seem to have a longer lead time than that. Projects like Donlin and other projects have been in those areas permitting for 10, 15, 20 years, some of them.
Okay, so this has been a successful program is what you want to tell us?
Yes, this has been a successful program, and including the reimbursable service agreement has been successful not just for DNR but for other agencies too to help recoup some of those costs.
Okay. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little bit, I have a question. Maybe it's a little more philosophical, but it sounds like we almost have a two-tiered system, that if you have money, you get treated differently and perhaps better than somebody that doesn't have the money and does not I guess my question is, it seems like everybody should get treated that way, and that process should work the same for everybody, but it sounds like that's my question to you. It sounds like we've set up a program that if you're a big oil and gas or mining operation, then you can get this expedited, transparent process, and if you are not, you get something different. So that may not be the intent, but what I'm hearing from this is that we've essentially set up that two-tier system. Could you help me with that one?
Mr. Goodrum, could you help Senator Schauer with that, and maybe a little history on why this program was put together to start with?
Sure. I'll give it a shot, Mr. Chair. Senator Schauer is through the chair. Obviously, there are a lot of very important projects for the state. Some of the most important ones deal with production of oil and gas or potentially mining. Those are very complicated, complex issues that involve multiple agencies, that involve both state, federal government, local government. Something that large and complex necessarily requires some amount of coordination in order for it to even be feasible for that project to work its way through the process. It is a voluntary program that they essentially provide an RSA some amount of money that will help cover the time that staff spends on working on that project. That same service is available to anyone that would like to probably come forward and say, I think that this particular effort is really important, and I realize there's multiple coordination points that need to happen. I think I would benefit from that service. So anyone could theoretically approach the Office of Project Management and Permitting and seek to acquire that same service. I think it's analogous to if you look at Priority Mail, or if you're content with snail mail going, you slap your stamp on it, and you walk down and you put it in the mailbox. If you know you want it there overnight, you pick one of two or three different folks that specialize in that type of service, because that's the type of service that you need given your time constraints and the money that you're willing to allocate against it. I think that type of service is critically important to our state and in our ability to generate some of these projects and the jobs and economy that comes from it.
Does that, Senator Schauer, does that help a little bit?
It does. Can I just follow up briefly? I guess what I'm trying to say is that the way it was presented makes it sound like if you wish to expedite your process, just pay us some money and we'll do that. And I understand that it's voluntary, but my concern is that you, like I said, it would be like a two-tier system. I guess you don't really have to answer this, but that's my concern of the way it was presented, because I would expect that we're already paying for DNR to do the job and that everybody gets that type of service, and that may be the intent, but the way it's presented, it sounds like you have created something that allows people that have money and want to volunteer for it can get a better deal. So just for what it's worth. And
I know. As I recall, when the system was put in, there was concerns of that very thing, that we would create inadvertently a two-tier system and or industry would, get some favorable treatment by, paying DNR to do the permitting, which isn't the case neither.
So when the legislature reviewed this several years ago, we took a pretty hard look at it. With at the same time looking at the backlog at DNR and the budgetary constraints, trying to figure out how to get a balance to have our permit process move forward. So there was, if you're so inclined, we could pull the old records and take a look at some of that stuff. But it was definitely, those issues were brought up and have been a concern. And when we have these presentations like today, that's one of the things we're always looking for, that we have equal treatment across the lines and we don't have our big resource extraction permits bound up too long in bureaucratic mumbo jumbo at DNR. So we have Senator Bishop.
Yes, I'd just like to share a comment. I'd like to visit with Senator Schauer offline and not take any time, but DNR does an excellent job for the small miners. And anyway, I'll talk to you about that. Thank you.
Do we have other questions on slide 25? Okay, we'll go on to slide 26, and then we're coming back to Mr. Goodrum. Is that correct? Okay.
And we'll advance to 27. That was just kind of our placeholder as we advance into the municipal entitlement land advance. As municipalities and boroughs come into being, the state works with the newly created government entity to convey vacant, unappropriated, unreserved land so that the local government has the ability to create an economic base and kind of get started. There's two ways in which municipalities or boroughs that are newly formed receive land entitlement. The first is in statute. Alaska Statute 2965030. It's a calculation based upon the amount of acreage that is vacant, unappropriated, unreserved, and 10% of that total state land value is the number that's originally allocated to it. The unique situation, obviously, within southeast Alaska with the Tongass National Forest, there's not a lot of state land, and so an alternate means for coming at a resolution for the amount of land that a new borough or municipality may be entitled to is the legislature can designate that amount. That was recently done, I believe, for Petersburg Borough recently. So those are the two ways in which that land entitlement is calculated. There's just a couple things on this slide that talk a little bit more about the determinations, and it's a bit of an iterative process between boroughs and municipalities and the division and department about priority land selections that they're interested in acquiring and how we go through a process back and forth. Ultimately, the decision is made to convey lands. Those lands then are patented to the municipality or borough once they've been surveyed. And those survey costs are a responsibility of the borough or municipality according to statute.
You're done with this slide?
Yes, sir.
So then how do we expedite this process, kind of like we had with the oil and gas, or the permitting, minings, whatever? Can you help the committee with that a little bit?
We, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a tough one for us to expedite. The best way to help do it is through good communication, clear communications between the state and the municipality or borough, and the more effective we are at that communication, the better that we can advance these processes more rapidly. Currently, the division has three personnel that work this issue statewide. It used to have four a couple of years back. One of those positions was reduced, and so we have a little bit less capacity at this time to work these statewide issues.
So that should be handled at the local level directly, or how do we, help me a little bit, because I've had concerns expressed to me that the process is a little slower than the communities would like once they've have the ability to have the land conveyed, so they could get it to on the tax rolls.
Right. Mr. Chair, I would first encourage the municipalities or local governments to work closely with the municipal entitlement section within our Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and continue those conversations. And if they've got questions or concerns, they can obviously come to you or they can come to DNR, and we can work to help try and resolve those and expedite this process.
Okay, thank you. Senator Schauer.
Separate topic real quick. And my memory may be off a little bit, but I think the Division of Habitat is proposed to be eliminated at Fish and Game. Have you, if I've got that right, if that does happen or did, is that, how would that impact your ability to coordinate and look at permits? Would that, is that something you've thought of, or if not, maybe?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, I'm not aware of that. We would have to work closely with Fish and Game to see what ultimately comes out of this process and how the two departments work together moving forward, looking at projects statewide. So I don't know enough about it to give you an intelligent answer at this point.
That pretty much completes the presentation today. We have a question from Senator Muchiki.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you get back to the committee? I think there's been an impression put out there that the project management capabilities of the department are set aside for the wealthy and enormously profitable, as opposed to the idea that government services also often have an avenue. And I'll just, the example is a passport. I suppose rich people can always apply for an expedited passport, but they don't. That's why they're rich. But if they suddenly find that they have to go to a funeral in Portugal of a distant relative and they don't have a passport, they use the expedited process, even if they're poor. So I guess the way to explain that is even the largest companies often don't use the service unless there's a scheduling issue. They don't use it on lower priority projects, and some very small companies are going to use it in the right context. So you might help clear that up. I'm not sure that happened on the record today, but I would be interested in seeing the differences on those two types of uses from, I think what you'll see is the same companies use both the expedited and the unexpedited services.
If you can get back to the committee on kind of the breakdown of how often the expedited services is used and then the standard process, because I didn't get the impression that it was presented today that only the more liquid companies pursue this. It's, I think, more along the lines of the scale of what is being applied for. So if you could help us with that a little bit.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to get back to you with a good, coherent answer from the department, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine, that's what we'd like. Any other questions? Just closing comments?
If I could, it's just slightly aside, but if you just give me the liberty to just share a little bit. Today is the opening day of Major League Baseball, and it's one of the ways that I communicate with my dad, who's in Iowa. He's a long-suffering Milwaukee Brewer fan who last year had an exceptional season. But and one of their players, Christian Yelich, who was the National League MVP, you know, had just a spectacular season, obviously. But anyway, his quote today, I think, is really important and related to what we talk about today. His quote was, "What matters most is what happens next." And you can have the greatest season in the world, but if you don't follow it up with continued excellence and continuing to strive to get better every day, you're going to fall short. And so I just wanted to share that quote. I thought it was really pertinent to today's conversation, and thank you for the opportunity for sharing that.
Okay, and that's going to pretty much conclude the presentation today, though I would like to note that I hope a decade out, Mr. Goodrum isn't sitting here at the end of the table presenting the same issues like almost a decade ago to the same folks. Some of the stuff just kind of goes away. So we're heading back into the future, I guess. So So with that, we're going to go ahead and conclude today, and I thank you for coming for us. I think you were a good presenter today. You had the historical knowledge of being involved when it was highlighted here at the committee that we had a problem and how the agencies worked with the legislature resolving. I think you've done a very good job. We'll keep an eye on it and work with you in the future so we don't go back to the 2600 backlog. That didn't help anybody. So that'll conclude today. Tomorrow at 9 a.m. sharp, we'll have Senate Bill 43, Extend Big Game Commercial Services Board. So we'll see everybody's smiley face at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. We are adjourned.